I would indeed encourage you to take a little time after the service today, and as Advent proceeds, to really study and look at the paintings that Josh has constructed. The more you look at them, the more you see. There's a lot of symbolism embedded into these paintings, and they're really quite profound. Noticing this morning, first time I saw the second one, but the kind of continuity and juxtaposition of pointers is fascinating to behold. So I encourage you to look at that. Also, just a note before we read our text for this morning, and that is that I fumbled the ball a bit this past week on the title. It's designed to be, the subtitle is Redefining Value, Not Redefining Want, in case you were wondering. But let's start with reading our text this morning. Just three short verses in Mark's opening. Verses 6 through 8 of chapter 1 in the Gospel of Mark. Feel free to listen or to read along if you prefer. Beloved, listen to God's word. John wore clothing made of camel's hair, with a leather belt around his waist, and he ate locusts and wild honey. And this was his message: after me will come one more powerful than I, the thongs of whose sandals I am not worthy to stoop down and untie. I baptize you with water, but he will baptize with the Holy Spirit. The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Okay, I want to start this morning with a wee bit of a test of your memory, if I can. So I'm going to start a phrase, and I'm going to invite you to finish it. Let's see how we do. I tested this on Michelle, and she did okay. Let's see if we could do better as a congregation as a whole. All right? Coke is it. Very good. And feel free to speak out loud, too. All right? Pepsi, the taste of a new Nike. Just cornflakes. Taste them again. Very good. Wheaties. The breakfast of. Oof. Lots of Wheat eaters. KFC. It's finger. Burger King. Have it. Wow. Molson Canadian. I am. How about milk? Got, or this one, WWJD, very good. Walmart, save money? Wow, excellent. How about LG, life is good. We have a lot of commercial watchers or something here. This is excellent. I didn't know these. Reebok, I am... No, you're going to get confused with beer again. No, Reebok is I am what I am. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. How about Aston Martin? Here's a harder one. Power, beauty, and... Anybody? Power, beauty, and soul. That's quite a promise. Volkswagen, think... PJ? Think small, right? Is it think small? Or das Auto, the auto. Harley Davidson, American by birth. No Harley riders here at all. American by birth, rebel by choice. Disney, the happiest. Apple, think different. MasterCard, there are some things money can't buy, for everything else there's... Oh, I said too much of it. American Express, don't leave. Diamonds are... That's what Michelle said. Are forever. Okay, how about some jingles? Toys R Us. I don't want to grow up. Very good. Folgers. Folgers. The best part of waking up. Excellent. Kit Kat, give me a break. Give me a break. Kit Kat bar. Very good. Okay. We'll come back to these slogans in a minute. Okay, stop chattering. You're cutting into my time. We looked last week at the concept of need. And we saw that although Mark says that what we human beings need most is to recognize our sin, to repent of it, and to receive the gift of forgiveness. We saw that what we human beings in North American society feel like we need and act like we need is more stuff. We love stuff, and we love our choices between different stuff. As a consequence, we are stuffed as a society. We're overstuffed. We're consumers who love our consumption and continue to consume and consume and consume. That's what we looked at last week. And so today, what I'd like to do to begin with at least is to ask, but why? Why do we love our stuff? Why do we love our consumption and keep on consuming and consuming so that we've become, indeed, a society built on consumption? Why is it that we Homo sapiens have, for all practical purposes, become Homo consumians? We value highly our consumption. And what is its impact on us as individuals, on our communities, and especially on our good world, the good world that the Lord has made? Furthermore, if not stuff, what does the Gospel of Mark suggest that we ought to value as the highest priorities in our lives? That's what we're going to look at this morning. And it's actually going to take me a while to get to our text. I'm warning you ahead of time. The reason for this is because I'm going to embody the message of our text in the majority of what I do. But I will come back explicitly to the text at the end. But to begin with, I want to pull back the curtain a little, as much as I am able, and for us to ask and try to answer, why do we value consumption excessively as much as we do in North American society today? Why do we value consumption? I think now the advertising slogans we've just described reveal a lot. The reason we value consumption and consume as much as we do is because we believe, and we've been led to believe, that this stuff that we buy and purchase and experience will make us happy on the one hand and or imbue us, infuse us with a certain value on the other hand. I mean, in terms of happiness, seriously, right? If Coke is it, then Coke is going to make me happy. A Honda may be okay, but for some, a Volkswagen is das Auto, and a BMW is the ultimate driving machine. Who can't be made happy by that? The truth is, from a very young age, we learn in our culture that stuff will probably make us happy. And we begin to grow a desire in our hearts for stuff. If I could only have that big ball of blue bubble gum in the bubble gum machine, the three-year-old thinks, I know I will be happy, mommy. I want that bubble gum, and that bubble gum wants me. If I can just get my hands on that new pair of jeans that everybody else in the school seems to be wearing, then I know I will be happy, says the teenager. If I can just get the newest console out there this year, with a few new games, I know I'm going to be happy for a very long time. I remember when myself and my siblings were young and the Christmas catalogs would start coming through the mailbox, right? And the glossy pages. And we would go through the glossy magazine and play an affectionate game called I Want That. And we would go through and like greedy little kids, I want that! Oh, I want that! I want that! And our desires were lifted up. Michelle and I are not little kids anymore, but we still play this just in a different form. Now we go through appliance magazines and see a refrigerator, French doors with the stainless steel coating, shiny, and we say, I want that. But we don't only want things because we think they'll make us happy, we also want things because we have come to believe that they will actually infuse in us or associate us with some kind of value. And this is even deeper yet. They will make us look better, more likable, and maybe even show others how we've stepped up the social ladder. We've achieved a certain status because of the things that we possess, right? Or they'll give us something. Take Pepsi. Let's take some innocent ones. The taste of a new generation. I mean, wow, don't you want to be at the vanguard? Don't you want to be at the front of things? If you're the kind of person who wants to be ahead of everybody else, all you need to do is drink this fizzy pop. It's the taste of a new generation. Or take Wheaties. Losers eat cornflakes, right? Because this is a product that you got to keep eating and taste them again for the first time because maybe they're doing something to your tongue, so you have to have a first time over and again. But Wheaties is the breakfast of champs. And so, do you want to be a champ, son? Come, eat your Wheaties this morning and you can be a champ too. Or hey, again, you want to show how strong you are, how patriotic you are? All you need to do is drink Molson Canadian, a beer that's mostly made of rice. But hey, I am Canadian. Or hey, again, you want image? You want the chicks to dig you and to dig the bad boy in you? Then Harley it up. Vroom, vroom, and become a rebel by choice. And while you're at it, please, while you're at it, don't forget that your package on your new Harley will not be complete if you're wearing those sweatpants. It will not be complete until you acquire a few more items. You'll need the leather, the gloves, the boots, the shades, and if you can sport it, the little itty-bitty black beanie top. And maybe a few tats too. Voila. Now you have the image plus the best bike made on American soil, hands down. Don't you feel like you can walk a little more confidently with a little more swagger and a little more swing? Watch him step off his bike. I wish I had a Harley. Now some of you will doubtlessly say, yeah, you know, others, but not so much myself. They're susceptible to that, but not me. And I want to say, okay, really? Tell me you don't buy stuff based on the secret value. Yes, secret value the product promises to give you. Let me ask you something. Why do we never take the logos off the things that we buy? Why don't we take them off? Why do we wear clothes and drive cars with brand names on them? What is the logo actually adding to the product you've purchased? Gap, Banana Republic, Lululemon, Lexus, Audi, Tilly, Starbucks, North Face, Gucci, Rolex. A lot is added actually by these logos, aren't they? And these names. Amazingly, each of these products contains and carries their own mystique. They promise you a certain value or meaning or significance by association with the product or by the celebrity that's promoting the product. And therefore, they each of them have their own unique curb appeal to help you build an image. This is exactly the point of branding, brothers and sisters. If an advertiser can get you to associate their product with a certain feeling or a social status that appeals to your desire for greatness, or strength, or sex appeal, or relational stability, or peacefulness, or well-being, or you fill in the blank, and then can offer it the right price too, they've got you. And this is the whole machinery, folks. It's not that we think these products will make us happy. Or it's not only, rather, that we think these products will make us happy. It's not only that we feel they will give us value. It is also that there is a huge, powerful, profoundly coordinated, calculated, and yay, manipulative system that is working super hard and overtime to, don't miss it, manufacture certain desires in you. To arouse desires you already have, but to manufacture certain desires in you so that you will go out and buy that product. You need it. It will make you happy. It will give you value. Do not be mistaken. There are powers out there that want to manufacture desire in you to get you to buy. And it works. This is absolutely critical for us to understand, I believe, in the church. This is part of what it means to pull back the covers and realize the world that we're in so that we don't get too much stuck in the world that we're in. So let me take a step back for a moment and work to pull the covers back, if I can, even a little bit more. So let's do a little bit of a history lesson here. How did we come to be the consumer society that we are? And the individual consumers that we are today, valuing our ability to consume as highly as we do. Here's a very brief outline of what could be a much, much longer discussion, okay? I'm going to give you a bunch of stages in the history of what's happened to us in society over the last maybe 150, 200 years or so. Stage one, Industrial Revolution. Machines are built. Machines that can transport. Machines that can work faster than humans, and machines, therefore, that can produce more goods and deliver them, far more goods, whether furniture or Fords or fuzzy sweaters, than are actually needed by the people who might buy them. Machines produce at an amazing rate. So picture in your head a factory with 10,000 wooden chairs sitting in it. Stage two. Producers of all these more than is needed manufactured goods must now solve a very highly pressing dilemma. With their warehouses full or quickly filling, and always with the desire for more money, of course, how do they ensure that people are consuming products, as Sky Jathani puts it, at a pace equal to the rate of manufacturing? Put it more bluntly and more personally, how do they now convince consumers like you to buy products you do not need? Picture now in your head the owner-operators of this chair factory standing before their 10,000 chairs and wondering about how they might push them out as fast as possible into the general public. Stage three, solution to the dilemma. It's quite easy. The producers of these goods become marketers and advertisers of these goods. They don't wait until the person in their local community has a need for a new set of chairs and therefore comes to their storefront and buys them probably for the newlywed couple who don't have chairs yet that are likely to last them a lifetime. But instead, they now insinuate their presence and their voice into the life of these people by radio, by television, by full ads in the Sunday newspaper, or by little flyers that come through your mailbox incessantly. They do this in order to arouse the desire or to manufacture the desire for their product in the consumer. Manufacturers now not only manufacture products, they manufacture desire for those products at the same time. It's very significant. So picture now in your mind a glossy full color page advertisement with a shiny maple walnut stained chair with a dapper gentleman at that time smoking a pipe sitting in the chair. Or an uptown lady with a fine dress and lovely crossed shaven legs, and then the caption, "More than just a chair, elegance defined." Suddenly, an item that was once sought after precisely or primarily for its utility, its usefulness as a four-legged seating device, or maybe sought out because of its relationship to the producer, Uncle Joe, who is the town's chairmaker. This product is now sought after because of how it makes the consumer feel like a distinguished, elite, pipe-smoking member of society. Stage four. As the ads begin to work and people begin buying new chairs they don't need, the old chairs end up in the dump, or in the fire, or in an early version of Craigslist. A cycle of buying and discarding with rapid speed has begun. Chair in, chair out. Start over. Novelty and consumption are bedfellows. Stage five, in order to capture more customers for products that they don't need, introduce creditors to those with lower income so that they also now will have the capacity to borrow money from somebody they don't know so they can buy things they don't need but have been made to want. Already in 1901, the marketing expert Emily Fogg Mead said, quote, "We are not concerned with the ability to pay, but with the ability to want. Buy now, pay later is born, and so is a society who is in debt for things that they don't need." Stage 6, sellers realize and are cautioned explicitly by the retailing gurus and retail analysts to be very careful. Do not make your product too good. That's right. Do not, for any reason, make your product better than it needs to be. Make it only as good as it needs to be in order to keep consumer confidence. Why? Because you, the producer and retailer, need to sell now to live. Your livelihood depends on people buying and then buying again. So if you make your stuff too good so that it never breaks down, see the writing on the wall, man. You're going to go out of business very quickly. So embrace a new strategy. Planned obsolescence. It's a fancy word that means exactly what I've just said. Plan obsolescence. Make your products good enough to maintain consumer confidence, but not so good so that they won't have to come back and buy another one and keep your business afloat. For a toaster, 5 years is probably good. A dishwasher, 3 to 10. A vehicle, 20 years max, maybe. A new computer, yes, a new computer. How long did your last one last? A year, two, maybe five if you're very, very lucky. And remember, computer makers always, always change the plug fittings so that if they had three cords, which are really convenient, one at work, one there, one here, now they have to go out and buy $80 cords and pieces. Keep it going. Either that or keep introducing novelty so we can exploit another problem. Perceived obsolescence, right? Planned obsolescence, it does break down. Perceived obsolescence, it doesn't break down, but you feel like you need a new one. iPhone 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5.5, 6, 6.6, 7. The 6 is obsolete now because now 6.5 has a feature that I really want, so I get rid of this one and buy a new one. By the way, if you think this concept of planned obsolescence is a bunch of bunk, and that there isn't a very calculated machinery behind it, consider what the retail analyst named Victor Lebo, who was writing in 1955, wrote. He wrote a letter to retailers, to producers, that literally reads like a letter from Screwtape to Wormwood, if you've read the Screwtape letters, instructing and teaching merchants about how to effectively manipulate their customers' desires. And Lebo reminds his audience in throughout the course of this about how to manipulate them, go for their desires, create this desire, focus on their emotions. He says this as well. He says, quote, "We need things consumed, burned up, worn out, replaced, and discarded at an ever-increasing rate. We need to have people eat, drink, dress, ride, live with ever more complicated and therefore constantly more expensive consumption. Why? Because the producers' lives and or increasing wealth now depend on it. The system depends on it. If people stop consuming, the system collapses. It's over. Therefore, at all costs, keep the consumer consuming as much as possible." Some of you will remember 9/11. What did the states tell their people? Don't stop buying. Then the terrorists win. Go out, spend money, get out there. Don't be afraid of the economy. Stage 7, damage control. While constantly insinuating to the majority of the population with Walmart that to spend less is to live better, ensure that your consumers do not start asking questions about where the product has come from and under what conditions. Keep focused on their desires, their wants, their perceived needs. Keep everything about how the product will bring them value as hungry individuals instead of as members of a global community in a very small world. Why? Because in order to stay competitive, you're going to need to use more of the Earth's resources and use more of the world's most valuable people who will work for pennies in slave-like conditions. So keep the slogans coming, the jingles sprightly, and the distractions at a maximum. Stage 8, and finally, live life as usual. Buy and don't ask too many questions. Just keep on consuming. Invent things like the happy holidays or Mother's Day or Father's Day or Thanksgiving weekend or whatever else so that retailers will have a reason to give you to go out and shop and buy more and spend more. End of stages. Okay, beloved, that's the history lesson. And you can see as well as I can where it's led us. It's the world we live in today. As Henry Nouwen once remarked when driving through LA, he said he had the bizarre sense, as reported by Sky Jathani in his book entitled The Divine Commodity. I highly recommend it. Nouwen was traveling through a dictionary, he felt. He said, "Wherever I looked, there were words trying to take my eyes from the road. They said, use me, take me, buy me, drink me, smell me, touch me, kiss me, sleep with me, consume me." And we have consumed. And we keep on consuming a ton. And the costs have been and continue to be huge in all sorts of ways. I mean, under this paradigm, what are you fundamentally as a human being? And I'm not talking theoretically, I'm talking practically. What are you as a human being? An image bearer of God with intrinsic value? No. Not so much, or at least not in practical terms again, because what you are, first and foremost, citizen, is a bundle of desires who must have your desires created and then satiated yesterday. As Jathani goes on to report, according to the New York Times, every day each American is exposed to 3,500 desire-inducing advertisements, and there's no difference in Canada, let's be honest. All promising that satisfaction is just one more purchase away. Rodney Clapp says, "The consumer is schooled in insatiability. He or she is never to be satisfied, at least not for long. The consumer is tutored that people basically consist of unmet needs that can be appeased by commodified goods and experiences. A century of manufacturing insatiable desires has created a culture of overindulgence, obesity, sexual promiscuity, skyrocketing consumer debts." And now this sentence, this is the humdinger. "Although lack of self-control has always plagued humanity, for the first time in history, an economic system has been created that relies on it." Let me read that again. "Although lack of self-control has always plagued humanity, for the first time in history, an economic system has been created that relies on it." Do not be deceived. If people today began suppressing their desires, he goes on to write, and consuming only what they needed, our economy and society would indeed collapse. To prevent this, the satisfaction of personal desires has become sacrosanct. The fulfillment of desire has become the highest good and the final arbiter when making decisions. End quote. Do you hear this? This is really serious. In this anthropology, in this worldview, your desires and my fallen, twisted, perverse desires are sacrosanct. They are holy. They are the highest good. They can arbitrate what the next decision might be. They are also, and here's the censure, they are also, as advertisers know, shapeable, manipulatable, create-able. A desire you at one time didn't have, you suddenly now have. Thus, you can be manipulated far more easily than you think you can. Shaped into wanting and buying things you don't need, and you are. The manipulation, in fact, is unbelievable. And it is pervasive. And in my opinion, I think it's frequently wicked. I really honestly do. And let me just illustrate this really briefly, because I think it's critical for us to begin to be able to see how this is going on in our world. Okay, take an early, seemingly innocent Oscar Mayer wiener commercial targeted at children. It is one of the most adorable, catchy, fun, emotionally rousing commercials you have ever seen, and many of you will have seen it. It is also completely poisonous. Some of you might remember it, seeing it featured the most unforgettable jingle with little dancing children through the street singing what? I'd love to be an Oscar Mayer wiener. Yes, that's what I would really like to be. I wish I was an Oscar Mayer wiener. Then everyone would be in love with me? Are you kidding me right now? That is wicked. I am not joking. That is wickedness. First of all, why would any human being want to be a wiener of any sort? Let alone an Oscar Mayer wiener, a salty protrusion of questionable meat fragments that somebody's going to eat. Second of all, the insinuation that becoming such a wiener will make that child lovable is a detestable bit of advertising, actually, if I ever saw it. But boy, is that commercial cute, and the jingle is so lovely. It conceals the utter poison inside. Right? And so we go out and buy the wieners. And then we start calling our children little weenies. Hey, little weenie, come over here. It's totally crazy. And much of advertising is like this, right? Let's pick on one more just for fun and for exposure. What about women's cosmetics? Let's return to our little game, right? Maybe she's born with it or... Wow. L'Oreal. Because you're worth it. Estee Lauder, bringing the best to everything we touch. CoverGirl, easy, breezy, beautiful CoverGirl. Lancôme Paris, believe in beauty. Clairol Herbal Essences, it's a tutti frutti shampoo. It is a totally... Nobody dares saying it, right? A totally organic experience. Wow. All that from a shampoo. Incredible. Right? And not a cosmetic, but probably targeted it mostly at women, this ad. Hallmark. When you care enough to send the very best. See the manipulation there? The insinuations. You want to send the best? Are you the kind of person that cares enough to send the best? Do not go ahead and pull out a piece of construction paper and write a handwritten note. Got to go to Hallmark. Absolutely got to go to Hallmark. Do you want to be truly beautiful? Well, then these cosmetics will do it. It's outrageous, but we go for it again and again and again, pulling out our wallets, handing over the money, credit cards, and it leads, as Hillary Mayle of National Geographic comments, to the production of some really mouth-dropping statistics in our world. For example, World Watch reports that worldwide annual expenditures for cosmetics total in the U.S. again is $18 billion, right? On cosmetics, facial paint. The estimate for annual expenditures, and this isn't anything against people wearing makeup. Please do not hear me saying anything like that or this person. It's not about that. This is just looking at the big picture, okay? The estimate for annual expenditures required to eliminate hunger and malnutrition in the world is Only a billion more. It's 19 billion. Expenditures on pet food in the U.S. and Europe together, total 17 billion a year. That's pet food. The estimated cost of immunizing every child, providing clean drinking water for all, and achieving universal literacy is less, $16.3 billion. Our system is broken, brothers and sisters. It's broken. It's really broken. And it is breaking us in its wake. Our new anthropology pushes us to consume more and more and more. But it is not making us happier, and it is not giving us the value we need. Yes, we might have it for an hour or two, or maybe 5 years, but then when it goes, we go too. The whole consumer mentality, in fact, which puts our desires and wants at the center of everything, is in fact leaving us emptier and shallower and given more to trivial pursuits. We run after trivia. It's also, and here more gravely, leading us to treat one another as objects to satisfy our desire. We can now today view other human beings very easily as consumables whose value is not intrinsic and inalienable, but it is tied up. This isn't spoken, it's practical. It's tied up with one's usefulness to me or to society at large. Explains why abortion is now seen as acceptable and doctor-assisted suicide for Canada is immediately on the horizon. It explains why people use other people sexually in the way they do today, like objects to be used for pleasure and then discarded as disposable. Our valuing of this consumer mentality is killing us, silently, but really. And not only us, but our churches and now our world as well. I'd love to spend some time this morning talking to you about how the consumer mentality is killing the church and doing some very damaging things in the church, because we are conditioned to come in here saying, how are my needs met today? And we go out saying, how did you like that today? When in reality, the question we have to be asking ourselves is, how did God like what happened today? I'd love to talk to you about that. But I want to, because of what's going on in our world, the Paris talks and so forth, I want to talk to you about what it's doing to our world, and very briefly. In 2012, a task force presented a study to the Synod of the Christian Reformed Church on whether or not climate change is anthropogenic, which means caused by humans. Before sharing their positive conclusions, that it is, on that question, the committee reports on some mostly uncontested, non-disputed ways that all of our mighty production and consuming is impacting the world. They said things like this. You know how it's impacting our world? Well, the injection of pollutants and chemical and compounds into the Earth's atmosphere. It is doing that. There's no dispute about that. It is throwing stuff up in the air. Soil and land degradation. That is happening. The introduction of 187,000 new foreign chemicals into our world. The soil, the waters, the air, and into our food. The destruction of 2.2 billion acres of natural lands for human uses has already been done for our consumables, an area that is just slightly smaller than China's total land area. That's been wiped out. And especially in the tropical areas of the world today, forests are being wiped out. It removes about 25 million acres of primary forest each year. The bulldozers are running. The area, the size of the state of Indiana every single year. And of course, if you're running over forests like that, what else is happening? Species extinction is happening, as you might witness, especially some of the older members of our congregation, with the lack of butterflies you see in the summertime anymore. Scientists are saying, what is happening to all the butterflies? The point is, all of our stuff needs to come from somewhere and be produced somehow from the Earth's natural resources, and then, because it's been made to break down or be consumed immediately, to be disposed or recycled. And all of this is taking a toll on the environment. And according to a great many of the world's scientists today, I know it's disputed, but according to a great many of the world's scientists, on the climate. The earth is warming, they say. And if temperatures raise too high, the results will be catastrophic for many and especially for the poor. Now, I don't really care very much if you believe in global warming or not, and I am certainly not qualified to convince anybody about it, nor do I aim to. I'm not a scientist. However, what I do feel comfortable saying this morning is that, brothers and sisters, for a whole host of reasons, you know what? We could do better. And we must do better. And we must, first of all, because, as our contemporary testimony says, our world belongs to God. We are just stewards here. And so when things harm the environment, we ought to care about that as caretakers of God's creation. That's the first. And the second reason is because, in addition to the other reasons already mentioned, listening to the following video that's been produced by the Office of Social Justice of the Christian Reformed Church, it leaves it undoubtable that we've got to do something if we are listening to those who are the most vulnerable. So if I can have that video.
I think it's important to remember that we as humans depend on creation for our livelihood, for our well-being, and that the issue of creation care isn't just about creation. It isn't just about nature. It's also about people. Creation care is very much about people. And the reality is environmental degradation, the manifestations of climate change are affecting the poor first and most acutely.
Africa is in fact the area of the world that is going to suffer the most from climate change. And that is a tragedy. That is a moral tragedy, because Africans have contributed almost nothing to the problem. We from the temperate zones have got to seriously consider what we're doing to actually help farmers, communities to adapt to conditions that they didn't cause, we caused. And yet they're going to suffer the brunt of the problem, which is already being observed throughout Africa right now.
When a fisherman comes and tells me all the corals are dead, my fish, I can't get fish, I can't get food for my family, you know, and I'm able to trace that to global warming and hence the higher temperatures in the ocean. This is real. You cannot deny that, you know?
And we don't know all the answers to the questions. We don't know what's due to this and what's due to that and whose fault is this and whose fault in that. That's not important. But are we willing to make a commitment that we will follow the line of questioning like a scientist would all the way to the end, wherever that leads, even if it means we have to look at our own idolatries, our own lifestyles, and say mea culpa.
This is something that affects the poor first. And everything that we do in order to rebuild, restore, revivify, or to care for the creation and the environment is also for the poor. I believe right now they're almost synonymous. Caring for creation is caring for the poor. Poor people are the ones who live in the most vulnerable environments, and they suffer first.
And if we are to be people that preach good news to the poor, Jesus said, then I don't see how we can do anything but care for creation.
So if we claim, as Christians, to have a gospel that preaches good news to the poor, liberation to the hostage and to those who live being bound by the constraints that they live under, those who are poor, in other words, if that's the good news, if the good news of the gospel means anything at all, and if we proclaim it, then at the center of that has to be the good news that creation is also redeemed, being redeemed, and it's our job to be co-creators, co-redeemers. And we simply have to have creation and its care at the center of the gospel to the poor, or we're living a lie.
Let me draw this to a close by making explicit what I've attempted to body in the message from our text. What are we as a church to value as our highest priorities, or among the highest priorities here? Verse 6, John wore clothing made of camel's hair with a leather belt around his waist, and he ate locusts and wild honey. That's a prophet's outfit. More specifically, it is the prophet Elijah's outfit. Elijah lived in a time of tremendous compromise among the people of Israel and the nation of Israel, and he went into it and he called out their idolatries. He disturbed the status quo. Our vocation as a church is exactly this: to have a prophetic voice, to call the world back to God's truth and to God's standards, rather than living in our own way and the consequences that unfold as a result of that. Verse 7, what else should we value? And this was his message: after me will come one more powerful than I, the thongs of whose sandals I am not worthy to stoop down and untie. It is tempting sometimes to challenge the powers that be, the hierarchies that are, by becoming an anarchist and saying, the end with all hierarchies. But that's not what John does. Instead, what John does is challenge false hierarchies in exchange for a true hierarchy. The reality, as John realizes, is that there is one who is greater than him in both person and work, and his name is Jesus Christ. He is the one that John is not worthy to stoop down and untie the sandals of. He is the one who is going to baptize the world with the Holy Spirit, which is to say, he is going to give the world a new heart, beginning with his church, so that we can live now in the world in a way that corresponds with our prophetic witness, so that the world will be made new. What do we value? We value those in our midst who disturb the status quo in order to bring God's kingdom to bear in this world. And also those in this world, the church, by God's grace, who recognizes not that there isn't a hierarchy, but just what that hierarchy is and why. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, on the second Sunday of Advent, we just ask humbly that you would enable us to live out your vision for us as your church, that we would be faithful to you in every way that you call us to faithfulness. We confess that we do not have wisdom apart from the wisdom that you give us, and that oftentimes we need new desires to be placed in our hearts, because our desires are twisted and have been twisted. So give us a new heart, Lord. Give us new desires, and let us be courageous, although always loving, prophetic witnesses to our world that this world belongs.